Stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Bit great today, isn't it?
I'm here. Welcome, everyone. Enter, strangers. Spellcasting. D, E, E, P, E, S, T, L, O, E, R. It's the deepest lore. But unfortunately, Horus, you didn't pick up the apple on stage two, so you have failed the quest.
Dong! Ooh, nasty.
How are you doing, Horus?
Good, thanks. Yeah, it's good to get killed as soon as I start the stream, but that is about as harsh as Nightmare is. So
I was watching, I just watched, before we came on air, I started watching Series 2, and the first team were just like gone in 10 minutes, just like, yeah, bye. New season started. Let's kill off the new team straight away.
Say about the deaths. Sorry, I just think a lot of what we'll talk about is the deaths, and you know that's the major theme: people getting killed.
Oh, absolutely! It's Nightmare is quite an amazing thing, and in fact, as we'll get into, quite a major part of my childhood that I'd. You know, I kind of locked away in there, but when I started watching it again, it all started coming back to like just how much centrality and importance I gave it when I was growing up as well. But we'll get into that in a second. I'll just mention a couple of things at the start. There's an extra show on AA Gold tonight because Red Hawk, the notorious plate spinner, has got some objections to the Women's Hour review of his article that happened last week. So he will be on a bonus stream later on AA Gold to critique the critiquers, as it were, or to review the reviewers. And he's got like insane notes. He's got an 18-point rebuttal that he wants to share. So that will be interesting. I will also mention if you haven't joined the channel, buy a mug. Subscribe to my Substack. There was actually a free article just this weekend gone. Most importantly, buy a course. That is the main way of keeping us in business. If you buy a course, you will get many hours of learning in return. I recommend the Trivium or Foundations of Politics or any of the other courses. So with all of that out of the way, Horus, is there anything you'd like to share, sir, before we continue?
I was just wondering, when is Foundations of Dungeoneering coming out? Is that a while yet?
I mean, I do have a friend called Morkar, and I noticed that there's like a side character in Nightmare who looks quite a lot like Morkar. Did you see him? Let's have a pull up this.
Does Morkar look like Lord Fear or what?
No. Let me just show you. Hold on. Characters. Opposition. No, he becomes a good guy. I'll show you now. Okay. So this is the character I have in mind. What's his name again? This guy on the left.
Hodris.
Hodris the Confuser. There he is there. Looks a lot like Morkar from Hero Quest.
From Hero Quest.
Yeah, so if you have a look at Morkar from Hero Quest, let's go for Evil Wizard. That's probably the right thing. If you have a look at the Evil Wizard from Hero Quest, look, it's the same guy. Look.
Okay. Yeah. Which one is older? Was Nightmare or I'm guessing Hero Quest might be a little.
I mean,
older.
Hero Quest was right around the same time. I mean, Nightmare came out in 1987.
Yeah.
And Hero Quest came out in same year, was it?
Wow. A bounty.
No, 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 1989.
Wow.
So maybe the designers of HeroQuest watched Nightmare and got the design from Morkar from Modred the Confuser.
Well, no, you mean Hordris the Confuser. Modred was quite scary. Was HeroQuest, because that was a Games Workshop thing, right?
HeroQuest was Games Workshop, yeah.
And Games Workshop was founded by Ian Livingstone and Steve Jackson, who made the Fighting Fantasy series as well, right? The books.
That's right.
Go on.
Carry on, Horace. Sorry.
I think there's a slight delay. Sorry, I don't mean to talk over you. Games Workshop, I believe, created HeroQuest. They certainly did Advanced HeroQuest. Maybe, yeah, HeroQuest Original might have actually not been them. I'm not sure. But it looks like they've ripped off from Hordris anyway.
I only went into a Games Workshop once ever, right?
Please.
And
That's not true.
This was about in 1998, something like that.
You only went in there once as a customer after having worked there for 4 years, yeah.
I went in there looking for HeroQuest stuff because my friend and I, like, we did like a HeroQuest renaissance in like 1997, 1998 sort of time. I was just into the game. I came back and found all my friends painting the figures. I was disgusted. I was like... What's all this painting things? I'm just in it for the dice and the quests and things. But anyway, we went looking for extra expansions and things of HeroQuest, and I went to Games Workshop, and I walked in. I said, "Have you got any HeroQuest stuff?" And they just literally laughed. They laughed in my face, and then I left again. I think HeroQuest was just done by the mid-90s. It was just like a long gone thing. So they just, you know.
I was a Warhammerer, but we had HeroQuest at home first. I think we got it as like a collective present for Christmas, and we really enjoyed that. It was a really, really good board game. And then I got into Warhammer because my older brother was into it, and so I spent a lot of time in Games Workshop. So I was one of those kids who was like in there for a whole day. You know, it was like a day out to a shop. and they sold, when I used to go in there, which would have been, I'm thinking, from about 92 to 95 or 6, maybe, quite a long time. I probably spent quite a lot of money on it for a kid anyway. But they used to have Advanced HeroQuest. That was made. And there was also Space Hulk, which was somewhat similar. There was another one as well. There was another space equivalent of HeroQuest as well. But they had Advanced HeroQuest. That was made by Games Workshop, I guess, because it was a lot more like RPG playing. And
the
two guys who founded Games Workshop were like, they were steeped in RPG. So
I was going to talk about this actually, because I was thinking about like, what was the thing that got me into kind of fantasy stuff as a kid? And honestly, it was probably this show. It was probably Nightmare that got me into the whole idea of, you know, dungeons and a dungeon master and, just the idea of this kind of quasi-medieval kind of fantasy world set in a kind of, in a game setting. And from there, there was also the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, you know, the little gnomey Games Master guy in it, if you remember that.
Yeah.
So there was that show, and then HeroQuest coming out was major. I was into HeroQuest as well. And I think that was the gateway into a lot of other things, you know, like it would be like computer RPG games in the 90s. I had a game called, there was one called Return to Krondor or Betrayal at Krondor. That was one I had. There was one called, obviously, Baldur's Gate came out in 1998.
Wow.
There were ones that people have forgotten about for the Amiga and things that had like maps and, you know, you'd get the game and it came with a bunch of extra stuff, yeah. like a booklet probably as thick as the Bible, you know.
And so the book contains a lot of lore as well. There'd be like mini stories,
all of the lore, and then like the original, you know, like Daggerfall. I'm just talking like in the you know, what RPGs were like in the 90s on computer games. But then, of course, like, if you were to stick with board gaming, you'd probably advance from HeroQuest to Advanced HeroQuest and then finally play D&D or something like that. Yeah. If you got that far, or you'd go into like Warhammer or some of the other games that you mentioned there. It was probably Nightmare that was the gateway for, I mean, not if it was the gateway for me, it was probably the gateway for millions of kids in the UK. So we should probably explain what was Nightmare to anybody who's either too young or foreign, or like, what, if you could explain to the audience what on earth was Nightmare?
Well, obviously, it was aimed at children, I think, from any age up to maybe 16. Probably wasn't of much interest to those older, but the contestants seem to go up to about 16, I think, and as young as maybe 11 or 12. There's quite a big difference between those age ranges in terms of what they're capable of, and. The Dungeoneer was the kid who would put on the Helmet of Justice, which blinded them apart from what was directly, you know, could see directly below them. And they would be guided through the dungeon by their three helpers who could see and who between them could help solve. I mean, the kid, you know, the Dungeoneer was able to join in the riddles and stuff. In the first couple of series, one of the main challenges you'd encounter again and again was you'd enter a room that was apparently plain, and then one of the walls would come alive, and they, you know, be called a wall monster. But yeah, Granitas was one of the first ones.
Granitas. Yeah. I was going to play some clips for us as well. Both of the clips I've got lined up are from series one, just to give a flavour of what it was like, but continue. I'll play them in a moment.
I think most fans of this program would agree that series one and two were the best. There was things to complain about in all of the other series, but it was still good enough that I watched it all the way to the point when it was cancelled, which was after season eight. But it was it had a wow factor for the late 80s, especially. It was really advanced, like visual technology. For the time, it obviously looks, you know, probably quite dated now, but there was some real artistry to it as well. The guy who was like the main art designer for the backgrounds seems to have been much admired and like did a really good job and created the first.
They were hand painted, weren't they? They were hand painted in the series one and two,
which I had no idea until just today. I was just reading about it, but yeah, it was hand painted by, I think it was called Mark Howe or something. It was very much admired by everyone else who worked on it. And I think the best thing about the first few seasons, especially, is it had a real sense of constant danger and sort of trapped. You know, you just need to keep moving onwards into ever greater danger. You can't slow down. There's lots of different devices in this program to make you hurry up. And you've got Traegard, who's the dungeon master. In the lore, he completed the dungeon. He was the first person ever to complete the dungeon. That's how he became the dungeon master.
I didn't know that. And he did it alone.
Yeah, in the Nightmare book, there's actually four Nightmare books. And in the first, in each one, there's like a novel and then a game, like a choose your own adventure, fighting fantasy sort of game. And in the first one, it's him completing the dungeon with no help. But he also can see. So... especially in the first few seasons, he's sort of your friend. He helps you at certain points, but he also laughs when you get killed, which is absolutely brilliant.
This is like perfect dungeon mastering in my mind. Like he's like, okay, I'll guide you, but also, I mean, one of the things that struck me watching it, Horace, was just like how he chastised the team as well. Hurry up, team. Yes. Hurry up. You've already been given the clue. What are you doing?
Which is great. Like, I mean, yeah, I can totally understand why the producer would want that as well. It's just to move it along. So it's never like just a plain, you know, nothing happening bit. But also, he admonishes them when they get killed as well. He's like, you knew that you needed gold to bribe your way through. And then they don't get to reply and he just dismisses them. And that's it. On to the next team. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we should explain, I've been seeing some people in the chat describe it as the Dark Souls of the 80s. And one of the reasons is because it's so fucking hard. It is punishing. I watched all of series one, just prepping for this show, expecting at least one of the teams to win. It doesn't. No, they get to... No. I thought the last team, I was like, oh, they've saved the winning team for the finale. And then this last team, who've been going for a couple of episodes, they just walk into a room and it's just like, yeah, there's a bomb. The bomb's gone off. You're dead. And Traegar's like, ah, oh, you walked into the wrong door, stupid team. Goodbye. You know, it's just... It's amazing. It's so good. Let me just play some of it to give a flavor for those who've never seen Nightmare before. Not that I imagine anybody who's watching this has never seen it, but let's have a little watch. Hold on. Oh, and the one thing I'll say going into this as well, title music is awesome. The theme tune is just so cool. And one of the things that I really appreciated watching it back as an adult is just how straight it was played. I was like if you were about, I don't know, 8 or 9 watching this, genuinely quite scary. You know, like there's no hint that Traegar is messing around at all. Like he plays it dead straight in these early seasons. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Yeah. He adds to the menace and the thrill of it. It's brilliant.
Let's have a little watch.
Welcome, Watchers of Illusion, to the Castle of Confusion. Phase with us now for this.
We've got the bloody, we've got the bloody dreaded low frame rate. Sorry about that, folks. Sometimes happens here in the lodge with the Wi-Fi connection. Sorry about that. But let's watch a bit more. You can get the voice at least.
This is the time of adventure. I, Traegar, issue the challenge. Beyond that portal lies the Dungeon of Deceit, which I alone have mastered. But those of you who cross the boundaries of time must master it also. The first is now without. So, enter, stranger. Who challenges my dungeon?
David Campbell.
You have some small previous experience of dungeoneering, I hope.
Yes, I have.
Very well.
That's another aspect of this I love, by the way. It's the actual kids themselves. They were just like, hey, I'm David from Norwich, you know.
Yeah, it just doesn't fit. It doesn't fit at all.
Well, and what reward do you seek here?
I seek knighthood.
That will not be possible. Only the first step to knighthood.
But straight away, slap down. You can't have a knighthood, mate. Get out of it.
Can be taken here. Squiredom is the reward for surviving the dungeon, for silver precedes gold, and the silver spurs of a squire will be yours if you survive. Now you know you may have 3 advisors to aid you on your quest. Call them to us, please.
David, James, Lucien, come.
There. Well, I can't say I'm over-impressed, but then appeared...
I just love the fact this kid on the right, he's got his, like, you know, stoned out blue jeans right up to his belly button in the 80s manner. It's awesome.
Appearances, as we know, are so often deceptive. Who guides this dungeoneer?
I'm David Hemp from Cranfield in Bedfordshire.
James Hoggett from Wootton, Bedfordshire.
Lucien Morris from Cranfield, Bedfordshire.
Well, I'm sure you'll do. And if you don't, someone will find the results amusing. Now, to matters of the most serious. David, Your quest through the dungeon is for truth and justice. Justice, of course, is blind. And when you don this helmet, you also become blind. Although you'll find there's just enough vision to examine and collect objects.
Just a quick question, Horace. Would you have preferred to be the dungeoneer or in the studio? What role would you prefer to take in Nightmare?
Well, I applied to go on the show and I was going to be the dungeoneer, but the reason for it was that the other three kids that I was going to be on with were all in the top set in school for everything, and I was only in the top set for most things. So they needed we needed the cleverest ones behind the camera.
Can I just say as well, when you were watching through, did you get all of the riddles correct? Because I didn't.
Not all.
Fucking hell. These are hard. They're hard for adults, not just hard for kids.
What's really good is some of the kids get some of the hard questions as well. They know a lot about mythology and stuff. Because at least in the first few seasons, all the questions are like mythology, some nature stuff, like plants, animals, and that. And they do pretty well for little kids. But there's one question where it's like, what? The answer is Saladin. And I never had any idea who Saladin was until I was in my 20s.
I was screwed up by that. I was watching with Mrs. AA. I was like, "What is it, Muhammad? Saladin?" Saladin. But I literally only knew that because of Civilization. I'll be honest, Sid Meier's Civilization had
right.
One of them has got Saladin as a leader. So
I think that was Civ 4.
One of the questions that caught me out from Gravitas was, when he's talked about, like, oh, where in this land is the, like, what is the, you know, and what caught me out is that he was talking about, like, this land is in Britain. And I thought, well, you know, here in this realm or something. And I thought he meant the world within Nightmare. So I didn't get that one. But,
One question that I didn't get was they asked, like, what were bows usually made of? What tree? Would you know that?
Oh, God, birch, I have no idea.
The ideal tree. Maybe it's like English or Welsh bowman, I don't know. But yeah, the answer was a yew tree. I never knew that.
No, I didn't know that either. But how these kids knew it, I'll never know. I mean,
they got it right as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things, is that I had the other assumption I had coming into this was that it's hard, but it's like unfair hard, i.e. it's just luck. But one of the things I realized watching back through is, actually, if you got all of the questions right, you could actually increase your, like, I don't know, if you get all three Gravitas questions right, he'll basically tell you which object you need to pick up later on, rather than it just being a guess. So it's not actually clear whether some of the deaths are as unfair as they appear, because if you'd kind of 100%ed it, you could actually get through. Although it also seemed to me that some teams got a harder run through than others. Like
they definitely did. We should discuss this. I don't know if you're going to carry on playing the clip, but this is quite a major thing. Like it was unfair. It was not harsh. It was also unfair.
I mean, I'll give you an example. That team that I thought was going to win at the end of series one, they're going through and they reach. They reach that monk, you know, the end of level two boss or whatever he is called, or is the end of, he's the end of level one boss, right? Before the monk sitting by the well, I forget his name.
Cedric.
Yes, Cedric the monk, right?
Yeah.
And they're about to do his three questions, and you know, most teams going through, like we were saying, would need to 100% those three questions, and the questions are fucking hard. And he says, as part of his spiel, like, you know, if you answer all three questions correctly, I'll become your servant. But like, fat chance of that happening. Basically, nobody ever does it. But on this occasion, Folly the Jester turns up and he's like, challenges him to an insult duel, Monkey Island style, and defeats him in the instant duel, and therefore like wins on behalf of the contestants. I was like, well, none of the other teams got that. So
it was
give them a leg up, you know?
Yeah, was that due to something they did with Folly a few screens before, or was that just good luck?
I don't know. I didn't see anything in particular special that they did to get Folly to.
I don't think so. Yeah, there's many instances you could cite that are like that, where There's just like other teams did the same and got worse luck or better luck. That happens because in the books it's quite specific that if you have no other clue of which way to go and you're presented with two or more exits, you always take the right. The right is the side of good. The left is the side of darkness and evil. Right. In the program, that is applied occasionally and arbitrarily, and just every now and then someone dies just for going left when others didn't. That's just completely unfair. But
yeah, one of the teams that, in fact, I think it was this same team, because one of the things I noticed about this team is they bickered a lot. The three kids in the studio. This is the team that gets really far in series one at the end, but then like dies to the bomb room, right? They end up going left when they should have gone right. But one of the things that team does all the way through is they check the objects for clues. They're like, oh, well, is there anything on it? Like the bar of gold's got a crown on it, you know, little things like that. Where it's like, you know, there is a lot of obscurity in the quest. Where it's like, you know, there could be tiny little indicators of what to do, but at the end of the day, how the hell were they, you know, there's something they missed that would have told them to go right. I actually think it's because they got the third Merlin question wrong on that quest, because Merlin gives them one spell even though they got two correct. I reckon if they got three right, he would have said, yeah, by the way, in a couple of rooms down, go right rather than left, or something like that.
Yeah, I think that is the case. There's at least one time though when I noticed that they got killed and it was just luck. There was no way, there was no clue as to what to take, and it wasn't, there was no questions, there was just, you know, there was just clues and you just had to choose them. There was no wall monster or Merlin or Motley or Folly or anything, and they just chose wrong. And Traegor tells them, oh, what did you bring the horn for? That's no good to you. Oh, well, it's too late now. But they didn't know. But apparently, I was reading today on nightmare.com, which is quite a good website, that apparently the producers sometimes decided that a team was boring and just gave them bad luck. Seriously. Like the people, like, I think the producer himself said that. Like, we had to create good entertainment. It's not just about fairness.
I watched that one with the Jericho earlier on, and they have a choice between a dagger and a horn, and Traegor just says something like, "Why did you bring a dagger when you're a blind man? You know, a weapon that you cannot yield. You're dead." You know, it's just like, again, maybe Merlin would have told them. I don't know.
In the book, it does give you some sort of indication, like offense will always serve you better than defense will always serve you better than offense because you're blind and things like this. Yeah. So, but in the TV show, you get no guidance like that.
So let's watch a little bit more. I just want to get them into the dungeon so that people can see what it looks like if they've never seen the show.
Objects from directly beneath. The others remain here, where with magic they can be your eyes. Their voices will reach you through the helmet. Now, the dungeon ahead is an alien place, and so to sustain your progress, a sprite of energy will travel with you.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
This is its manifestation.
Now, this. Imagine you're like eight years old watching this, as we would have been. It's actually quite, like, do you think they show this to kids today, or do you think they consider it like inappropriate for children or something?
I think loads of things about Nightmare would be considered like too nasty, too death related. There's also like a lot of the sort of adult actors, like they manhandle the children and stuff. That's probably ruled out now and things like that. So
yeah, or they insult them, you know.
Or they make as if to hit them, but then obviously like it's kind of covered up. But one kid gets hit with a staff on the head and stuff like that.
If people haven't seen this, it turns into this slowly, the flesh comes off and it turns into a skull and it shows the life force. Warning team, life force dangerously low.
And the last thing.
It is your own life force.
So I was just going to say the last thing you see if you're about to die is there's just parts of the skull coming apart and flying off. And there's just two eyeballs left and then they fly off and it's just like, It's really sort of visceral. Yeah,
and then a gong. Gong. It's so
I love the gong. I love the gong.
And must be fed with food, which you will find occasionally on your quest. This is condition green. On condition red, you are in great peril. For this is no game for a player with numerous lives. And when this one's done, your adventure is over.
Yeah, no second chances. It's so unforgiving.
Yeah, yeah.
To feed your life force, you must place any food in this knapsack. But place only food there for any other objects.
The other thing I notice is that the timing on the life force draining seems to be very inconsistent. Is there, when they're interacting with a character, I assume that's put into a free state, and that it's only life force only drains when you're like in kind of, I don't know, like out of an encounter type thing, because it seems to be like
it's entirely decided by the producer. I think is like as they go along, it's just to hurry you up. That's all it is. Just it's just for the to speed up the entertainment because they was added in post-production. The graphics were actually added in post-production. So they're never, you know, when they say, oh, quick, like, you know, you've got to get that pie in the knapsack before the eyeball flies away. But no, that was all added in.
Well, one of the things I remember, I didn't manage to watch the later seasons for this. I only watched out one and two. But I seem to remember as a kid that there would be goblins chasing them, like with a horn.
That's right.
Goblins are coming. Right. Yep. When were they brought in?
Probably in season two. It's if they're not in the first season, I'm sure they're in the second. Yeah. Yeah. And again, that was a hurry up thing. They hardly ever got killed by the goblins. But yeah. What was the? You played Civilization 4, did you? Or?
Yeah. Well, I played all of them from one all the way to six. Yeah.
Same era, except I haven't played six. But in Civ 4, when you declared war, there'd be a horn go off, right? And it'd be like, do you remember that? That sounds like the same horn. I think Sid Meier was watching Nightmare.
maybe Nightmare just influenced all of the games and things. They were all watching the same as us. And then,
if they copied Hordris, they would copy everything else, yeah. So.
Yeah, I'm convinced that the Hordris and Morcar designs are too similar to not be a coincidence.
I think so.
Also be consumed. You will, of course, find other objects on your quest. Choose them and use them with care. And remember, you may carry only two at a time. Now, I am constrained to offer you certain final warnings, so listen to my words very carefully. On your quest, I shall be with you. And yet not with you, for there are places in the dungeon where even I may not safely go. The way to truth.
I quite like that dynamic, by the way, that there are certain characters who kind of keep Treyguard at bay. One of them is Lilith, who we'll see in a second, but I kind of like that mechanism where he's kind of warded powerful. Off by. Yeah. Because he appears in a little elude, like in a corner of the room, doesn't he, occasionally?
That's right.
It's tortuous. There is no correct route through the dungeon. But the right path can be found using logic and guile. The only way is onward. There is no turning back.
I'll just say that when we were watching it, when I was watching with Mrs. AA, she kept on saying, God, is he going to stop interrupting them? Because he comes in every he comes in quite a lot with quite lengthy spiels. What do you think about that?
Yeah. he really dominates the whole thing. Yeah, I was just wondering. Like, I mean, maybe you could put it on like 1.5 speed or something, because it actually talks quite slowly, doesn't it? Because I found that the pace of the actually waste quite a lot of time, which was one thing that was always annoying about it. The first couple of series it was good, but they found more ways to waste that. I don't know why. I don't know what that added into it. But
pickles and pickle. There was loads of like weird little interactions and things that slowed things down even more. I will say though that I think Treyguard is the thing that holds everything together. The show wouldn't work without him really, would it?
He's the beating heart of it. He like one of his main functions, as I said before, is just to get rid of teams quickly without them getting a word in and stuff. That's like, even when they win, there's like 1 minute of celebration. They just get given some sort of, it's just a trinket. It's like, you don't even see it. Yeah. And then it's just right, off with you, next team.
it's an amazingly kind of unforgiving circular world where it's just like a never-ending rotation of Dungeoneers coming through, enter stranger. It's like time is cyclical in the world of Nightmare, you know.
And when they bring Lord Fear in, I think in season 5, it becomes more obvious or more explicit that it's actually a game between Trayguard and Lord Fear. There's the powers that be versus the opposition. And the kids are just being thrown. They're just like GIs being thrown into like cannon fodder to just being run at Lord Fear.
Did you get? I've got one of my longest lasting memories of Nightmare as a kid was this team who actually reached Lord Fear. They actually got to him at the end. And I mean, one of the things we should say, I don't know how many teams ever won, but it wasn't many. Like there are whole like season 1 I saw had no winners.
Yeah.
Season 2, I think, has got one or two.
It's got two winners, yeah.
Season 3 has no winners at all.
That's right. And then season 4, there was at least one winner. And then season 5, I think there was one. Yeah, overall, there was 8 winners across the 8 seasons.
I mean, it's not, you know, it's punishingly difficult. I don't know how many teams there were overall.
And some of those were given a break. Some of those were given shortcuts and good luck and stuff as well. So
yeah. It's a very difficult game. Very few people ever won it. Also, it seems like the dungeon changes ever so slightly from quest to quest as well.
Mm-hmm. For each team.
It's not always the same. There's a lot of similar rooms, but how they're joined up, you know, seems to be more discretionary, let's just say. But my abiding memory is that there's a team who actually reached Lord Fear. They reached his chamber and he was there, but they forgot to pick up the mirror shield or whatever it was, and he just zapped them. He just zapped them, and that was it. And he did it really nonchalantly as well, and it's just like laser finger, and there it was. So I don't know if that's like a Mandela effect, like imagined memory, or if it actually happened, but it stayed with me for many, many years. So
I tried to watch all 8 seasons in preparation for this, but I just did not have enough time. I think I got through the first 5 seasons. What you said, I mean, Lord Fear only comes in season 5, I think. So what you said probably happens in the remaining 3. But I think I remember that, especially when you described how he just sort of like, just lazily just kind of zaps him. That really
it's almost like lying down almost. amazing.
There's one occasion when Lilith kills them, and they just didn't bring a bribe for. Oh no, she got a headache, and they.
I've actually got that clip lined up because it was an example of just how punishingly fucking difficult it was.
There was no way they could know she had a headache. The natural thing would be to bring her a bribe, but this time she's got a headache. And she doesn't want gold. She's like, I've got loads of gold.
Yeah, it's like they had a choice of pills or gold. And it's like, yeah, we'll take the gold.
Not this time.
She wanted headache pills, you know. let's get them into the dungeon and I'll play a bit of Lilith, because I don't know about you, but I think in the first 2 seasons, at least, the second strongest performance is Lilith. She's a very strong character, in my opinion. What do you think, Horace?
I think she's all right. I mean, I think all of the supporting actors are they're like pantomime actors. They're like, I've looked up a bunch of them. They're all complete nobodies except one or two of them. I think Pickle was in a few other things. He was in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, apparently. And also Alec Westwood, who plays Folly, was in Game of Thrones much later, but not much
was
else.
He?
Apparently, yeah. I don't know what role. I haven't really watched Game of Thrones.
I kind of like how Shakespearean Folly is as a fool. You know, he's very. But again, it's dark for kids. You know, he's like a dark fool. You know, it's not.
Yeah, it's weird. He's kind of mad, and he's kind of He's like, it's a bit unreal, and it does add to the darkness. Even though he's supposed to be a jester, it is still quite sinister, isn't it?
Yeah, I know they replaced him with a. Is it Motley the Fool afterwards?
Yeah.
He's a little bit more prancy and lighthearted, I think, than than Folly was.
He's a little bit more. He's a bit, little bit more lubricious as well. He makes like funny comments about the women and stuff like that, which is quite funny. But Folly seems more unreal. Folly's got this kind of cool makeup, and he's just, he's more like a sort of alien, or not an alien, like a sort of semi-real character. It's quite cool.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find some Folly in a second. But let's get them into the dungeon, and then I'll play some Lilith, and then I'll see if I can find some Folly. Hold on.
Well, David. Do you still wish to enter the quest?
Yes, I do.
Very well. Turn then. Face the door and take a step forward.
Have you noticed, by the way, that some of the kids laugh at all of Tregar's jokes and things, and other ones just stony-faced? I imagine David wouldn't laugh at any of the jokes, you know?
Where am I?
You're in a reasonably large room. Ahead of you on the wall, there are two doors with portcullises in them. To your right and left, diagonally, there are also two portcullises, two exits.
Do you think girls watch this show? Because girls occasionally were on the teams, but this seems like such a boys' show to me.
I would say so. But there was plenty of girl contestants, but I remember my older sister liked it. She's like quite a bit older than me, and she really liked it, so... Yeah, there's loads of girl contestants, like about 30 or 40% of the teams, I think.
Yeah, because there's a lot of character stuff, I suppose, that a girl gets.
I'm sorry, I don't know if you can hear me, but I've lost you.
I mean, even
AA, sorry to interrupt, but there's a lot of people saying robot in the chat, and I can hear you really badly roboting, so I don't know if you can hear me. They're saying spellcasting, T-O-B-O-R. Does that work? No, it doesn't, because I'm not a real dungeoneer. I'm not able to cast spells or dispel them. Oh dear. I don't know if you guys can hear me. I don't know if you can hear me, but oh, you've left. Oh, I'm on my own in the dungeon facing Lord Fear. Or I know, he doesn't really exist, does he? I'm not really in the dungeon. You can all hear me, can you? That's good. Well, I'll try and sustain the stream. I hope AA. Tell a joke, says Arbley. Okay. Why did the girl fall off the swing? Because she had no arms. Spellcasting. A-R-M-S. Nope, she still hasn't got any arms. Gutted. I never thought I'd be hosting a stream with such a huge audience. Look at the speed of the chat. Amazing. Oh, look, yeah, I got a laugh there from Essex. Oh, yeah, people like that one. That was good. So if I go through the left door, says Stan One. No, if I do that, I'll get killed. So that was bad advice, I think deliberately, I suspect. So I was going to be the one in the helmet because everyone else, you know, my team was in set one for everything in school, but I was in set one for everything except science because I think there were just too many people in set one. I was actually all right at science. So that was unfair, but all the same, that was the criteria by which it was decided I would be in the helm of justice. If anyone else watched it, did you think that the lady who was supposed to be like the guardian of the forest was quite beautiful? Do you know who I mean? History Bro says, tell us about the Maisky Diaries while you're here. Well, yeah, AA, everyone subscribe to History Bro's channel. You'll see it there in the chat. Click on History Bro. He's got a terrific channel. I've been on some of his early videos, actually. The ones about Mao Zedong. some of the first videos on his channel. But yeah, about the Matrix Diaries, that is a video on my channel. If anybody wants to see how I got famous, you go look at my channel on Odyssey. I got banned off YouTube for unfair reasons. But on my Odyssey channel, you can see videos called The Matrix Diaries and others, which you might like. Why the name Horus, says Tom Ricketts. Look, what has this got to do with Nightmare? I should be talking about Nightmare, shouldn't I? Why the name Horus? Just because when I was a kid, I thought that Horus, the Egyptian god Horus, was really cool in the way that he got destroyed and taken to pieces, and all the pieces of him were scattered all over Egypt, and he had to reconstitute himself from the spirit world or something like that. I just thought that was quite a majestic story. And that might have been his father. That might have been his father, Osiris, that he had to reconstitute. I can't remember now. And his mother was Isis, wasn't it? but yeah, I also had a game called Eye of Horus, a computer game. It wasn't very good, but it stayed with me. And that was where I sort of learned about the myth. Were Horus and Sargon contemporaries? What, Sargon of Akkad? I doubt it. I reckon Horus would be further back. I don't know how far back the Akkadians go, but talk about myself. Horus says he is the eunuch. Okay, I am doing that. I try not to because it sounds pretty egotistical. Yeah, Horus,
I am now back. Woo. I don't know what happened. It was like the internet just cut out, froze. I had to reset everything. It works again. So
yeah, well, Lilith. No, Hordris was pissed off that you thought Lilith was a better character. So.
Oh, was it? Well, to be in fairness, I haven't got up to Hordris in. I think he comes in series 3. I think. Yeah. But I was just going to. I was just saying before I cut out that I think there was enough. Even though it's an adventure thing, it's quite character driven, and there's a lot of like. I think there are a lot of elements girls could get into as well as boys. Yeah. Now that I think about it, so probably. Well,
it wasn't uncommon when in our age for girls to be into fantasy stuff. That wasn't that strange. Like they would like, you know, so it was way more boys, but you would still, if you went to a medieval reenactment day or something, you'd see plenty of girls there as well. It'd be, you know, things like that. So
yeah,
the sex lines became more clearly divided.
I mean, in my experience, like even girls can even play RPG games as well. Like, like board RPG games. They tend, I mean, without wishing to stereotype, they tend to be more into character interactions than into min-maxing their character sheet, if that makes any sense. Like, you know. So, anyway, let us carry on watching a bit more. I was thinking, by the way, that, because I was talking, getting into the difference between fantasy and sci-fi, and whether there's something about fantasy that plays into personality types more, or sci-fi that plays into personality types more. I was thinking about it, like what is sort of stuff have I been into usually? And I've definitely tended more towards medieval fantasy stuff than sci-fi stuff for one reason or another, apart from Star Wars. But then I thought, well, Star Wars is pretty much like a fantasy, just that happens to be set in space. It's just like, it's not really a sci-fi. Any thoughts on that before we carry on, like the fantasy sci-fi thing?
I like both. I do see Star Wars as kind of, well, yeah, I know it's supposed to be set a long time ago, but I do still see it as sci-fi. But yeah, I actually like both. I played both the Warhammers, which most people get tribal about one or the other. But I played fantasy and 40K. Yeah, I like both.
Let's carry on.
And a portcullis in front of each of them. On the floor, there are four letters. These are N, P, O, and E. The nearest one to you is E.
Open.
They spell open.
Not too taxing to start off with.
You're wasting energy, team. There's small chance of success if you allow this simple puzzle to floor you.
Get on with it. It's too easy.
I felt that portcullis and tended to stay open.
Well, take the right steps for further progress.
Turn right slightly.
He literally won't even give them like a minute to confer. It's just like, fucking get on with it already. This is, don't forget, this is the first ever, the first ever room that any team has ever been in. And he's just like, yeah, already get on with it.
Are they about to spell open wrong, though? They're heading for the P, aren't they?
Well, let's have a look. Well, maybe they think it's peon. Could be peon,
I suppose. Yeah. Or nope.
And turn left a bit. Forward until I say stop.
Remember, stop. That which turn does not slightly. Read right must be spelt correctly.
And say open.
Open. No, take the rest. Perhaps you can pick the letters up if you walk to them or something.
Yeah, drop them. Can you turn left slightly?
See if it has anything.
Did the subsequent teams get to watch this, by the way? Because no other team got confused with this. They just did it immediately, so...
I think they only do this particular thing once. I think afterwards they make it like just quicker, like you just get the word by stepping on one letter or something. You know.
It happens if it goes across.
And walk across the letter, if you can see it.
Okay.
Walk straight forward.
You can't see it.
Turn right slightly. And walk straight forwards a few paces.
What?
Right, so that's all this does nothing.
Okay.
Remember, spelt correctly.
They should be killed for this.
All right, turn round completely. A bit more.
Oh, dearie.
Yeah, but I mean, if they killed him for this, that would be like the shortest go ever, like a little less than a minute, you know?
All right, walk forward until I say stop.
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 Oh, it's tedious.
Turn right.
Oh, fucking hell.
Walk forward a bit.
They're not doing sidesteps either.
Stop.
Oh, Jesus God.
Oh, turn right again. Dear.
Right, now walk forward one small pace. Right again.
Hurry up, team.
Walk forward another small pace.
All right, you get the idea. You get the idea. I'm not watching them.
This makes it look shit, though.
I know. I've got a clip lined up for where they, where that Lilith gives them that extremely unfair death. I think it's the second team. So this team that we're watching now lose, and then this team with this girl come in, with this kind of Debbie Harry girl here on the left.
For anyone who's not seen Nightmare before, the first challenge is not always as boring. It's like they really made a meal of that. That's terrible. They don't even learn to use the sidesteps until a few teams have gone by. So,
yeah. Rookie errors from that team there, but let's see how they get on with Lilith now.
Should we take off the soap?
Just take soap. The soap.
Yeah, right. I'll pick it up now.
Just the soap.
Right.
Hurry, team. When Granitar sleeps,
turn to your right.
Olga awakens. Choose wisely but swiftly now.
Turn right again.
Yes,
and again. Yeah.
Forward. Trigon's like, I'm trying to tell you something. Can you shut up?
Right. Turn right.
Forward, maybe that was forward. It. Maybe that was where he would have given them the clue as to what the fuck to pick up, you know.
Yeah.
Where am I?
Don't go any further.
Right.
Stop there. Yeah.
It's a chasm.
You're in a room that's changing.
It's a chasm.
There's a great big drop at your feet.
At my feet?
At your feet.
I wouldn't move at all. Right, shall I go back?
Yes.
No, one step back.
That's it.
Yeah, that's better.
Yes.
Right.
Is she going to have to go through this wall?
There's something moving on opposite you. I mean,
in front of me.
How dare you? Out at once. Lilith does not receive unannounced visitors. And don't you know any better than to burst into a lady's chamber before she's even had time to do her hair? Apologize at once, rude girl.
Yes.
I can see you spies. There's one thing worse than people who burst through one's doors. It's other people who peer through windows. Listen, rude intruder. There is just some chance you may be able to do me some service. Do you have gifts? What precisely do you have?
A block of soap.
A block of soap? Kindly explain how I am to comb my hair with that. Oh, dragon's breath. I lose all patience with you. I will just have to throw you out. I have no time for those who bumble. So boulders crack and that ledge crumbles.
Fucking hell.
Now it's a blue to drop in.
That's so brutally unfair.
Oh dear, what a pity. Never mind. Maeve appears to have suffered a fatal fall.
I was reading on that nightmare.com that Lilith apparently racks up more kills than any other character, which I didn't realize. I think I don't know how many she gets in total, but that's the first one, you know. And I mean, this is just how dismissive, like, this is what happens when they die. Let me just show you.
What a shame you didn't take the comb when it was so obviously needed. Now your adventure is over.
Bye.
But I'm glad to say that's not the end of May. Look in your magic mirror and you'll see that
they don't get to say anything.
In the dungeon, she has survived in the reality you call your time. Time now for you to join her. Spellcasting, D-I-S-M-I-S-S.
Dismissed.
Farewell,
the remorseless Traegard. He's just, there's no sorrow. He's as happy to dismiss them as he is to congratulate them.
The other thing that I think is worth mentioning is his closing spiel, because at the end of every episode, he freezes time. So here's the bomb, like, here's one of these bomb rooms that they go in. Hold on.
Go forward.
Right, watch now. Okay.
Now where am I? You're in a room with a large bomb. It's just, the fuse is just lit.
Go! So turn, fucking move!
Turn to your left.
Go!
Go quickly forward.
Oh, I know, we're lucky there.
Warning, team. Complete temporal disruption approaching. Time is now the enemy. Oh dear. Temporal disruption complete. Time flies, as the Romans would say. And although all continues in your world, here time has flown. All adventuring must now cease until you phase with us once more. Will our team triumph on the next level? Or will our dungeoneer come to a sticky end? And if so, why should you care? For here, nothing is real, and everything must surely be an illusion. Join us again for Nightmare, and just keep telling yourself it's only a game, isn't it?
I mean, that's quite extreme for a kid's show, you know.
It wasn't just a game. I mean, if it was just a game, the rules would be more more clear and more consistently applied. It's primarily entertainment, but it was the most enthralling thing when I was a child. I wanted to be in front of the TV. I wasn't like this with anything else, but for this, maybe Games Master a bit later, but I wanted
to
be
into Games Master as well. Yeah.
That was very exciting, but I wanted to be in front of the TV as the credits started and all the way till the end of the end credits. Like it was my absolute most exciting thing. And I remember because it was on Friday evenings. I think it was always on Fridays.
One of the things that actually, I think, the story that I told that got us into even doing this show is that I used to set up, I had things like judo and various like clubs I had to go to after school. So I'd leave my mother instructions for what to record. And sometimes a show was so important, I put a star next to it or underline it. You know, I'd be like, this is the really important one. And Nightmare was like, I don't know how you, it was like S tier. It was like, you cannot under any circumstances miss this one. You know, if you tape nothing else, make sure you fucking get Nightmare. So yeah.
Or even if the house is burning down, get next door to record it or something. Yeah, it's crucial. I wasn't so lucky. If I'd asked my parents to record it for me, well, they wouldn't have been at home anyway. But they could have set the recorder, but they just would have said no. but there was several times where I just didn't get home, even though it was on. Yeah, for complicated reasons, I didn't get home in time sometimes. I'd miss 5 to 10 minutes of it. It's horrible. And then one time I was watching it and we were going camping for the weekend and it was like five minutes left or so. And I was like, can I just watch? No, you can't watch the end. No. And I just had to leave, which was painful. Really, really sad. And I just, didn't record it. Didn't record it at all. Yeah. So sometimes I missed it, which, it was bad, you know.
But so...
Well, there was one thing I was just going to ask you, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Do you, when you're watching it, do you sit there and wonder sort of what the graphics are concealing. Like, for instance, when Lilith struck the rocks from beneath them, you just sort of saw, it just went dong and, you know, the screen sort of closed up and you didn't see. But there's other times when they die from falling off into a chasm or whatever, and you actually see the kid fall. And yeah. I'm thinking, right, yeah. So is it a crash map? Did the kid know that they were about to fall off something?
Yeah, I was thinking that, like, because there's times where they have to climb into a well as well. It's like, well, I'm assuming there's not a well there. So where are they actually going? You know.
So does someone then just come up and whisper to them, right, we're just going to walk you to the next screen? You know.
the magic of television, eh? I don't know. I mean, I spent some time on the nightmare.com website, which is like so autistically detailed. I actually love it. I actually love the time and care. I mean, that's what the internet used to be about, just like extreme autism on things like this that don't matter. But I spent more of my time reading about the lore than about like how it's like behind the scenes stuff. So I didn't realize there was like backstories and things behind like each of the characters and so on. That giant from series one, like he loses that chamber to a troll, apparently.
Yeah. Right.
It's the same room, but a troll comes into it afterwards. So I don't know what happened there.
And the troll is creepy. Like the troll sort of, in one, they encounter the troll a few times, but in one time he's watching this kid right in front of his face, just licking his lips and stuff. It's like, I think that would be very distasteful. Now, I mean, obviously, you know, he means like he's going to eat him, but it's like, it's like unpleasantly suggestive at the same time. You know, there's quite a few things like that. There's one where a character called Sylvester Hands comes up, and like he's being covetous for whatever the Dungeoneer is holding, but he's really in his personal space, like hands on him and stuff. And it's like, ugh. You know, he's like, it's really sort of interfering with him. It's like, oh, get off.
Do you want to see a little bit of Hodris, the confused? What's his name? Hodris.
Hodris. Name. Yeah, he's
Hodris, the Confuser. Is it?
Yeah, he's a good character. Yeah.
Let's have a little look of him. Because you would put him above Lilith, would you?
I like him. Yeah. I quite like Cedric. I thought Cedric was quite funny.
Cedric the Mad Monk.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's played very well. He's kind of like this caustic kind of, you know, no-nonsense kind of. But he seems like he'd give you a good punch as well if he needs to.
Left.
Yeah. Oh, those are the goblins.
Yeah, and again, quick, and forward, quick.
Move. Warning, team. Fucking hell, look at this.
So these tunnels were a complete waste of time. Nothing happened in these tunnels.
Did anyone ever die? You know, there's that room where there's the spikes and they have to time the run. Did anybody ever die doing that? Because I feel like there are certain rooms where they just don't kill them. Like,
yeah. So there's the one with the fire coming through the floor. There's the one with the spikes closing in from either side. And there's also the scorpion. And I think in each of those, people blatantly get it wrong and they still don't get killed. So it's pretty...
What's that kind of skeleton archway thing? I claim that you can't die on that as well, because they blatantly touch it and they still don't die.
Yeah, it's called the catacomb bite.
Yeah,
they touch it. And he says one touch is deadly, and they touch it and he doesn't die, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty scary as well, that thing, that hologram catacomb bite thing.
Mm. Where am I?
Right, you're standing on a bridge over a great big chasm.
Yeah.
And on the bridge in front of you, there is some food.
Food.
Okay, Leo, do you want to go forward slowly?
Yeah.
Oh, hang on.
Stop. Really cannot pass, you know. Not before someone of higher breeding such as myself. No, you'll just have to go back. Or perhaps go down.
Gosh. There's almost no doubt in my mind that this was the basis for Morgana.
Morgana?
This was the basis for Morcar from Heroes Quest, without doubt, in my opinion.
Ah, right, yes.
This is an encounter with one who has many names. The Druids, however, call him Hordris the Confuser. He is neither specifically on the light side nor the dark side. I would say instead he is a distinct shade of dark grey and should be taken very seriously. You must find some way to impress him, for if he senses weakness, he could turn nasty.
You have offended my dignity. Prepare to meet your end.
Leo, show no fear.
I'm not frightened of you.
Are you not? What particular sort of magic action? This is too tiresome. Right. You have offended me. If you cannot show respect, I'll just have to show you some.
Spell casting.
Rise, please.
S-W-O-R-D.
Well, there's really no need to take that sort of attitude, you know.
Ooh.
If you really feel that strongly about it, then I'm quite happy to withdraw.
Wow, that
is. Thanks to you, sir. The path is all yours.
Should we trust him?
Wow, do they do that every time? That was an interesting way of getting rid of him.
Yeah, I think that was a waste. I think all you need to do is just show him respect and sort of make him think you're his equal, kind of thing. By what you say.
Have they blown that spell now? Do they need it later on?
I think that's it. They've used it.
You must dispel or the sword will turn on Leo.
Dispel. D-W-O-R-S.
Okay, Leo, you're fine now.
Okay, so walk forward.
Yep, all right. Walk forward.
Go.
Is there any gaps or anything?
No. Yeah.
Did anybody die from, like, lingering too long? I never see anybody, like, actually die from lingering.
I think they always send in either the sort of the knight or the goblins to rush you along, and people always do. I don't remember anyone dying from lingering.
It's just to increase suspense, I suppose, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Can you see the
food? Something like a bread or something?
Yeah, put it in your knapsack.
Okay.
Yeah, done that.
Right, walk forward.
Where am I? Right.
All right. Was there anything else that you wanted to have a look at, Horace, before we hit the super chats, in terms of Nightmare? Any characters you want to highlight, memories, favourite teams, etc., etc.?
I actually sent you a picture of the front of the first book. You'll see it in backstage in StreamYard. It's just a picture of the catacomb bite. It looks like, I just had a quick search, it looks like there was actually 5 or 6 books. I had 3 of them, and they were good.
Right.
But yeah, I was wondering what you think of, like, how this relates to, I mean, I don't watch any children's entertainment today, obviously, but there you go, yeah. The cat and goon bite looks really scary there, right?
Yes, yeah. but like how it appears in the show is scary as well, I would suggest. I don't know. I'll see if I can find it, but carry on talking.
It's good that picture's got a lot of motion in it. It looks like it's just closing in on you and you're about to get eaten, right? I was just interested in what you think of, you know, whether this would be on TV, like how much this would be changed if it was on TV now. Because, like, obviously it's a lot to do with death, and people in charge of TV now, they don't like you to think in terms of the ultimate, do they?
No.
Life's more about, you know, just like much more, I don't know, much more modern.
I mean, I think there's an American thing as well, where Americans always have to, like, American entertainment always has to signal the fact that something is a joke, or that something's not real, or that something's not, that you'd never see it played straight in this way on American television, in my view, because they have to signal that for, like, you know, the slow kid at the back always. And I feel like the influence of American culture has been such that were this on today, they would they wouldn't play it straight. There would be more of a nod and a wink to the audience, as if to say, you know, they'd camp it up a bit more, I think.
I think so. I think you pointed out to me before the show, there were a couple of momentary revivals of Nightmare, right?
Yes.
Because it continued to be popular when it was shown on. Obviously, a lot of people remembered it very fondly, and it was a popular show at the time. But then, obviously, students and stuff were watching it on Challenge TV, and me. TV from sort of the 2000s onwards. So that helped sort of revive interest in it. And people tried to bring it back, including the creator was called Tim Child, who was already a TV producer, I think. And he created it in 87. When it was taken off air, it was doing fine. It was getting good ratings. It was really popular and stuff. It was doing great. But CITV just like got a new commissioner in, a new like chief, like a Tony Hayes sort of character.
Yeah.
A woman, and she just cleared out like most of the programs, including this, and just wanted a whole new profile.
Like no reason given for why this was got rid of.
Wanted a whole different lineup to CITV, and this didn't fit. Basically, I think she got rid of nearly everything, like including Funhouse and other good stuff.
That was another good show. I mean, I don't know. I don't know why you'd get rid of your best shows. I mean,
yeah, I mean, maybe this was quite high budget. I mean, it had a lot of actors and innovative technology and stuff, so maybe it was just not that profitable, perhaps. I'm not sure. It got good ratings, as I say. But so then there was also, you pointed out to me, there was like Nightmare Live. There was like a live version with Izzy.
Yeah,
Sessions.
And I have seen Nightmare Live at this board game convention that I used to go to every year. I've been a bit lazy since the pandemic hit. I haven't been like since 2000 and whenever it was, like 2019, I think, or 2000. Yeah, because the pandemic was 2020, right? But I used to go every year, and there was this thing called Nightmare Live on that. But it wasn't. It's not. It's like a kind of, you know, a. It's not like the original Traeger. It's like a kind of guy who goes around conventions. It's quite fun though.
Was it done with the same sort of gusto as Hugo Meyer put into Traeger?
No, it's much more of a comedy. It's like a comedy show for nerds. Like so, everybody there. I mean, and it was typically shown in a double bill with that other thing that's on. You're in a dark room, Darren. Now you die. So it was typically in the same sort of slot as that thing. You know, it was played for laughs, and there was like at one point they'd bring a massive D20 and roll it down the aisle. You know, it was
that little bit sounds cool, the massive D20. Because that's a different kind of entertainment, right? That's obviously sort of postmodern. That's like laughing at how serious things used to be or how earnest things used to be. And it's like, no, I definitely prefer the earnest thing. I mean, Nightmare was, you know, a little tongue-in-cheek, obviously. Like, there's jokes, you know, by Traeger about, you know, that relate to the real world or, you know, something like that. You know, there were joke at the end of one season about it being Christmas coming up and things like this, you know. So it was, you know, it was not 100% po-faced or serious, but you know what happened, like, with geek culture, right? When I was in school, to be called a geek or a nerd or a dweeb or a boffin or a dork, that was an insult. And for me, like, I was called those things because I was bookish, you know, I played instruments and stuff. I wanted then to not be a geek, right? I didn't want to be bottom of the pile sort of thing. So I tried to make myself more cool. And so in my 20s, I was more cool, right? But then what do I find? Geeks declared themselves cool and people started wanting to be called a geek. And then obviously, like, what do geeks do? Oh, we play board games, you know, we watch things from the 80s and stuff. It's like, what's this? You know, you actually want to be a dweeb? Like, what's that all about? So reviving Nightmare became part of that culture, which again is postmodern to me. It's like it's not the same thing.
Yeah, and I was also very unhappy about the attempt to make geeks cool.
Yeah, it's weird.
I actually did a video about it called "The Rise and the Fall of the Geek." I don't know if you saw it.
And the rise again.
Yeah. So my whole thesis in that video, I can just play you a bit of that video if you want, is where I basically argue that the attempt to make geeks popular, if you want, I remember it was like, it was done through Doctor Who and various other vectors. The attempt to make the geek popular basically resulted in, because there was status attached to it, then girls started attaching themselves to it because it was cool, not because it was geeky, and it destroyed the heart of the thing. Let's see if you can find that video. I'll just play a bit of that video, and we can have a little discussion if you want.
That immediately makes me think of genuinely quite hot cosplay girls and stuff, and
I've got a tiny clip, by the way. Apparently, the stream went down. I'm seeing that people said for copyright, so I won't play too much of this. But there is the catacomb. I mean, it's pretty scary. That's horrifying. Look at that. Absolutely horrifying.
Underneath him is a coin.
Underneath him is a pie. There we go. Let me just play you a bit of my old Rise and Fall of the Geek video, and I'll get some of your... Let me see if you agree with my basic take here. Hold on.
Greetings. It is I, Simon Quinlank, the original Duke of Hobby, here with another hobby to regale upon your ears if you currently are feeling that your hobby life is one hobby short.
When I was growing up, the geek was relentlessly pilloried by popular culture.
What you will need... some bourbon biscuits, a Virilin record or cassette, a flask of weak lemon drink, and a lockable room.
It was not uncommon to see scenes like this just on a normal episode of Children's BBC.
Yes, and as you can see, it is time once again to meet the Anorak.
I'm back! Hello, Zoe. It's so nice to meet you.
Yes, the man who knows everything there is to know about Children's BBC.
Do you remember him, Horace, the Anorak?
Yeah.
You'd never see him on TV now.
No.
Not in the same way. It would be a much more sympathetic depiction of the Anorak.
We know lots about you. Norma and I are big fans. We've watched you on the Ozone Playdays.
Oh, yes, lovely. Lovely, very much.
And we also know you like peanut butter and jam sandwiches, so we've made you some.
Oh, how lovely. How lovely. They smell funny. What's in here?
Pork luncheon meat as well for extra succulence.
Oh, gosh. Well, save those all till later on. Thank you very much, Anorak. It's now time to play Beat the Anorak. Claire, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hello, Claire. You ready to play Beat the Anorak?
Yeah.
Where are you calling from?
Peterborough.
And you've got your support there, haven't you? Gina's with you.
Yeah.
Cheers. Hello, Gina.
Hello, Gina.
And if you don't know the rules, all they have to do is answer questions about Children's BBC. The first person who knows the answer shouts,
oh, no!
Yes, just like that. Hit Claire. Let's have a practice.
You see, this only worked because he was made to seem abnormal against like the backdrop of normality, right? So it's obvious he's a figure of fun. Whereas you fast forward a few years and they're trying to make this same character into something like aspirational in a strange way.
I know!
Not loud enough!
Loud enough. Is everybody ready to play? Yeah. Then here we go. Quizmaster Zoe. Can you name, question number one, can you name our top new cartoon that begins tomorrow?
I know.
Claire, you were there first.
The Box Master.
Fantastic. 1 point to Claire. Woo! Okay, number two. Can you sing the theme tune to Biker Grove?
I know.
I know.
Oh, I think he beat
me
you.
Me first.
We definitely.
Biker. Biker. Biker Grove.
Yes, all right. But for a bonus point.
First, let us define our...
So basically I define geeks as being like obsessively interested in something. Collecting trivial bits of information about it, being socially inept, and being nearly exclusively white and male. Would you agree with that definition of the geek?
I remember Simon Quinlack as well, yeah.
And just to fast forward a little bit, so there's the... this was the attempt to make the geek cool through, like, Doctor Who.
Oh, God.
Appealing to women, you know. And then there was this sort of character... this was
Ben Whishaw.
Yeah, this was Q in the James Bond films.
Yeah.
You know,
he was Pingu in Nathan Barley as well.
And then this was The Social Network, if you remember. Mm. You know, with the depiction of Zuckerberg, and then we get all this bollocks, which is what you're talking about, right?
God, I didn't know it had actually gone this far. Yeah, I mean, and also the massive expansion of conventions in general as well.
That and then cool. And then all of this sort of thing where, you know, the Den of Geek and Mr. Plinkett. Yeah. And so all of these things, right? All of these things. You see, what happened is that everybody on the internet imagines that this is alternative culture, right? You imagine that the Mr. Plinkett reviews are alternative, but in fact, they are mainstream and dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody today in 2022 would say that red letter media is alternative media. It's not alternative. It is absolutely like the most watched movie show in the world. So you cannot claim that this is the counterculture. And of course, the thing is that in real life, this is the same kid who would have been bullied in the 80s is now sitting on top of the pile, if that makes any sense. So
it is. And also they were weaponized for basically critical theory or woke, you know, as they say now, that was easily fed into all these things that, yeah, like, you know, we're here for a Star Wars, we're here for Lego, but also we're anti-racist as well. Like that was all fed into it. It was all weaponized for use by the establishment as well.
Yeah. And I mean,
Gamergate showed that, you know, Gamergate was where there was a fight over that.
Yes. And one of the things I was going to say, though, just on the subject of red letter media, at some point I want to explore how vectors like this, the geek angle, right, is inherently like apolitical. Because
except frame, for racism,
right, apart from racism, right,
yeah.
The frame of geekdom, you can get into like a mindset where you're into the lore and you're into the thing itself, right? Therefore, the you're not really allowed to think outside of that frame within like the fandom. And you saw this a lot with Star Wars, right? With when there was the backlash against Rey and all the Mary Sue stuff. Do you remember all of that?
Yeah.
Where a lot of the people who are like T-shirt wearing like Star Wars fanboys had this kind of cope where it was like, well, this has been like all through Star Wars, fans have had a backlash against it. This is what it is. We have to accept it. And because my thing is Star Wars, like they made peace really quickly with that fact and then defended it because, you know, that's what you're meant to do, quote, in the fandom.
And what else are you going to do? Stop being a Star Wars fan? It's unthinkable.
But that kind of mindset basically makes you immune from like connecting Star Wars to anything wider. And then the flip side is the very famous reviews of Star Wars that Red Letter Media did. He was coming at it as a film geek as opposed to a Star Wars geek, right? So he was coming at it from within the film fandom rubric rather than the Star Wars fandom rubric. Mahler actually does the same thing in many ways when he's critiquing Star Wars. But that, of course, means that you're criticizing the prequels for movie-making reasons and not considering how they were actually this like pretty detailed critique of neocon foreign policy, which I want to reconnect people with at some point in this coming year, because I think people will look back on the prequels as the masterpiece of our time to understand the power structure that George Lucas was actually trying to get at in The Phantom Menace. And
what does Jar Jar Binks represent? I mean, I assume you agree with the theory about Binks being in league with or even superior to Darth Sidious, right? There's a serious case to be made for that, and it makes sense.
In my mind, Jar Jar Binks is best represented by like the kind of GOP senator, like Lindsey Graham or someone like that, you know, who holds up the more for Israel signs or whatever, you know.
I mean, you might think you're joking, but look at there's a couple of videos on YouTube that show this theory. I think I'll be interested to hear what you think. There's a strong theory that Jar Jar Binks very, very subtly is manipulating everyone all along. It's amazing. I'm no fan of Jar Jar Binks, but I like the prequel movies more after seeing that theory. It actually throws them in a better light. But just one. Oh, sorry, go on.
Yeah, we should get back to Nightmare, by the way.
Just one other thing, just to do with the geek culture thing. I mean, the same thing happened with atheism as well. I was amazed about sort of 7 or 8 years ago when I found out there was such a thing called the atheism scene or whatever it, you know, with like,
yes,
like YouTubers like Thunderfoot and people like that. I just never knew there was like, what is there to talk about with atheism? It's just don't believe in God, right? I mean, apparently there's a whole scene around it and it's all to do with science and stuff. That, again, it's like totally geeky in one way, but it was also weaponized for certain politics. Like, I think that ties in as well. I mean, like, you know, most people who would go to an atheism convention would also go to a Star Trek convention
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about why this is, and if you've ever been to any of these conventions, now, when I go to those conventions, I always feel a bit self-conscious, Horace, because I'm the sort of guy who might walk around in a tweed jacket, you know, and I, how can I say, like, I don't like smelly people. whereas you go to these things and there are a lot, you will see creatures from every walk of life, okay? And if you can imagine, those are people who are used to being ostracized and pilloried in normal society. So they go to the Comic-Con or to the board game convention as a safe space where they are free, where they are accepted for who they are without judgment. And there's no judgment in that space. It doesn't matter if you're fat. It doesn't matter if you're smelly. It doesn't matter if all you do is eat takeaway pizzas and pints of, full fat Coca-Cola. It doesn't matter if you speak with a stutter. It doesn't matter if you have no social skills. It doesn't matter if you spend every waking hour watching Star Trek. It doesn't matter what sorts of games you're in. The basic ethos of those places is non-judgment. You don't judge someone for their kind of character traits, because that's who they are. And who they are is a geek, man, or I'm a nerd, man, and that's my thing. It's not a million miles away from that to SJW values.
No.
You know, you don't judge me because I'm, you know, LGBTQ plus, or you don't judge me because I'm a furry, or you don't judge me because I watch, anime lolly porn or whatever.
Yeah? Furries are the bridge, if anything, aren't they? They're the bridge between geekdom and SJW.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that the cosplay angle is interesting here, because I feel like there's a lot of women who go to those spaces who dress up in the cosplay, right? It doesn't matter what they're dressed. They could be dressed up as Game of Thrones characters or superheroes or whatever. But it's a nice little chance for those women to dress, because if you can imagine, most people have gone there to play games or to be into whatever the thing is, right? Those girls go there to dress up and to have those men gawp at them, if that makes any sense. They get attention from it. Yeah. And it's obviously its own thing. And because there's this veneer of non-judgment, nobody really says anything about it. But there's this, how can I say, like, that cosplay element is a sneaky little attack vector whereby you can inject people who don't really have an interest in the thing into those spaces, if that makes any sense. Absolutely. So, like, the cosplayer is also, you know, some sort of like social justice activist, you know, inserted in there, and they don't actually have to, I don't know, understand the rules of D&D or whatever the thing happens to be, right?
Yeah. And they'll avoid any conversation that could expose their own ignorance about it. They just want to flirt with people and take photos and put it on Instagram and stuff. Yeah. The geek atmosphere, like, you know, when I was a genuine geek playing like Warhammer in the shop for a whole Saturday when I was, you know, 12, the atmosphere was so totally unsexual. If there was like a girl in the shop, that was quite unusual, but she'd be a really dweeby girl as well, right? Whereas when you go to conventions, there's like cosplay element, there might be quite a genuinely sexy girl, or like, you know, maybe she might have a rough face or something, but, you know, she's got loads of makeup on or a mask, so it doesn't matter. And when sex comes back into the geek culture, that's actually quite threatening to real geeks. You know, it's like, because I kind of got into this to not think about girls, you know, because girls always reject me. That's, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah. And then when sex and like, you know, who's going to get, you know, who's going to get a number sort of thing.
And the other thing about like genuine geeks in those sorts of spaces are, because of the sort of people they are, if they come into contact with like a real woman, especially one who's got like proper tits and like a nasty good look at, you know, dressed up as Batgirl or whatever, you know, or Supergirl or whatever she's come as, they'll crumple up and fold up very quickly when faced with a genuine woman, right?
Hide from her.
And so that, how can I put it? It's not just entryism. These cosplay girls have a lot of like weird power in those spaces over the fat nerds.
Take over the room. Take over the whole place. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's a very interesting dynamic to see played out in real life. I mean, all I do when I'm in those places is try not to look too disdainful, and to, you know, hide my natural contempt, because in actuality, I am the outlier in those spaces, not them, you know. So,
do you ever just ask, like, go to one of the cosplay girls and like challenge her, like, "Have you read Pareto? Have you read Pareto?"
I mean, in my experience, certainly in board gaming, girls can wreck a board gaming group. I know that much. If they actually cut, like, because they'll. You know, especially if you're in a serious group that plays to win, you know, and takes no fucking prisoners, you know, if somebody starts losing and they go into a pout, like, what do you do with that? How do you deal with that? You know, it's not a question that blokes are used to having to deal with.
And then one of your mates starts going out with her, and then you don't see him much anymore, and then you're not playing your game anymore, and oh, she's ruined it. Great.
Yeah. all of the above. Yeah, always happens. There is no, I mean, I've said many times, boys and girls can't be friends. And if it's a true male pursuit, it's very difficult to insert women into those sorts of settings without destroying the fundamental dynamic, in my view.
Which is essentially her intention, whether she admits it to herself or not.
So people are saying I'm coping, saying I'm not meant to be there. I mean... I don't know. Last time I went, by the way, for the first time ever, it started to get a bit political and they started doing like jokes at the expense of Brexiteers and things like that. I didn't like that. I didn't like that at all.
That really is dweeby as well. That is the mark of a dweeb. Someone who tries to make humor out of politics. It's like, oh, it's rubbish. I remember Stuart Lee. Sorry, I'm getting well off the point of Nightmare. That, you know, obviously this all related to Nightmare, as in the second iteration of Nightmare was ironic and sort of, you know, laughing at stuff. But just, sorry, I know you want to go to the super chats, but just before, like, Stuart Lee, I used to think was a really, really funny guy. I used to think he was a brilliant comedian. And in 2010, the Tories got back in and there was like a consensus among comedians, like, right, now we do political stuff, you know. Politics goes to bed when Labour are in power, because that's the way things are supposed to be. Yeah. And then now the Tories are back in, now we get political again. I saw Jeremy Hardy do the same thing at Glastonbury. It's like every joke, the punchline was just the Tories. It's like...
Yeah, I mean, I saw Stuart Lee live a few times. I think the Tories were in. And he didn't really get that political in those particular shows. Like, he talked about this was the one about like the paperclip merchant or something. I seem to remember, or like something about. I mean, it was all quite. I mean, I always rated Stuart Lee. I haven't seen him recently. I do know he's become like a massive twat recently, though, in terms of his being woke and all of that. I also used to like Richard Herring. I saw him live a few times too. I even met him. You know, after the show, he signed something, and both of them have just become. It's a shame, really, that there's nobody. Most people who are involved with these things have kind of massively gone in for like the woke thing, and it kind of destroys them. It just stops them being like, you know. I've seen so many heroes of mine succumb to that. Like Robert De Niro is probably the most prominent example. Like, there was a time when I would never miss a Robert De Niro movie. Like, you know, I watched everything, even like the obscure ones, like, I don't know, Angel Heart or whatever. But now I just think he's a twat, you know. Now, in The Joker, when Joker shot him, I was happy not just for the character, but also because, you know, Robert De Niro is literally that person in real life as well. You know,
sad. Did he direct that as well?
What, Joker? No. It was directed by. I don't know if he helped produce it. I can't remember who directed the Joker.
He's directed a few films, but none of them are very good.
Todd Phillips. De Niro is usually a producer on movies.
He directed The Good Shepherd, though. Did you ever see that? It had a lot of potential, but it just was disappointing.
I don't think I did see The Good Shepherd, actually. It's one of the very few ones that escaped, because I used to collect them on VHS. And you know, I'd have like my De Niro connection, my Pacino collection, and I don't think I ever got the Good Shepherd.
And then you moved on to Laserdiscs, did you? No, The Good Shepherd was in the 2000s. And it's about the early proto CIA, Skull and Bones, and all that. And it's quite interesting subject matter, but the film is just not that well directed. But it's not bad. It's not bad. It's just a little bit boring.
Yeah, I think basically I gave up on both Pacino and De Niro around. They did a film together called, I can't remember what it was called now. Was it called Righteous Kill? I think. Something like that. I don't know. I gave up in them sometime in the mid 2000s, where De Niro basically became this kind of parody of himself, you know.
Yeah.
You know, analyze Meet the Fockers and all that sort of stuff. but anyway, any final comments on Nightmare before we hit the super chat?
Well, just to sort of round it up, I just think it was really, really thrilling TV when I was a child. Really loved it. I was enthralled from the first second to the end, and I couldn't stand it finishing. I wanted another episode, another one. I didn't want to wait a week for another one. That's how exciting it was. And the fact that it was harsh and quite, you know, violent, at least implicitly violent, that added to the thrill of it. You take that away, it would not have, you know, it would be like cutting the balls off. It was pitched very well for the age group. It was, you know, who was playing it and who was watching it. It was my kind of thing because it was fantasy and like, yeah, medieval mixed with, you know, goblins and all this stuff. It could not have been better to my sort of 8-10-year-old self. It was thrilling. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And yeah, I've no interest in any sort of ironic remakes or later versions. They obviously missed the point. The point wasn't to wink at you. It was as you say, played straight. And I think that was the best thing about it. So yeah, I just loved it.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about like that whole thing of playing it straight seems to a lot of things were played straight in the 80s, you know, all of the Arnie and sliced alone kind of action movies were pretty straight up. I mean, there are a few one-liners here and there, but they weren't like winking at the camera saying, oh, this is a movie, by the way.
Total Recall does that, but most of them don't.
I'm trying to think of some other, like there was a, like the Conan movies came out, they're served pretty straight. All of the Sword and Sorceries movies that came out in the 80s.
Yeah,
so I don't know if, I don't know if that was like, you know, we say that Thatcher and Reagan didn't really do much on the culture front, but like on this show, one of the things that me and Farrow have done is look at adverts from different ages. And we noticed this with the adverts as well. Like there was a lot of like Chad men in the adverts and like women kind of imagining themselves like picking fruit in a lovely field, or you know, or there's a touch of romance, like if you can imagine the woman in the bath with the flake and all this sort of stuff. So, you know, there's a lot of like macho men and feminine women in the 80s. It's not done in a tongue-in-cheek way. It's served straight. And I wonder if when the 90s really gets going, it starts undercutting everything and making fun of all of those conventions. I mean, I'm trying to think of some examples in the pop culture that
I was fascinated by your stream about lad culture was a good example of that, and really, really interesting, I thought.
Yeah, I mean the lad culture thing had subversive elements, I thought, in the 90s, but I'm just trying to think of some touchstones that really, like, I tell you a pretty good example is Austin Powers. Austin Powers. Now, the Austin Powers movies were funny, right? But they were also postmodern, and they were also making fun of genre conventions again and again and again. There's another one I just remembered, Monkey Island, right? Now, the Monkey Island films are funny, and they're good. The Monkey Island games are funny and good, okay? And they probably still hold up now, you know, give or take a few, like, point and click. Some of the puzzles are really difficult at Monkey Island, but...
yeah.
It was also making fun of a lot of geek culture references, and it kind of turned in on itself. Now, if you can imagine that Monkey Island came out when, in like 1994 or something, you already start to see the culture start to critique itself endlessly, you know.
I did a chat with, I don't know if you know Urba Derba, but he's a fellow. I did a stream with sort of about this time last year. It's on my channel. It's called Joy and Cynicism in Entertainment, and it's about what I very crudely called the transition from the old entertainment to the new, where the old was represented by Keith Harris of Orville fame, and the new was represented by Louis Theroux, who did a program with Keith Harris after Harris was off TV, and he's doing like pantomimes and stuff. And it's the whole discussion is about what you've just mentioned. So I recommend people watch that on my Odyssey channel.
I mean, people are saying that Last Action Hero does that. Last Action Hero came out in 1993, if memory serves, or if it wasn't 1993, it was the early 90s at the very least. And what I'm saying is that by the time the 90s swing around, you've already seen like a dozen Arnie action movies. So, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger starts to star in movies that start to make fun, like starts to unravel and make fun of itself. You know, I'm doing Batman month next month. And if people want to start preparing if you want to play along at home, I'm not only watching all of the movies, including the DC animated ones. I'm also going to do a comic book run, like looking at all of the trade paperbacks from Nightfall up until the present. I won't go any further back into the Bronze Age or anything, but it's going to be a pretty, like, it's going to be a study in autism, the Batman month. I'm going to try to do it justice. But if you have a look at the Batman movies, you know, Tim Burton, okay, it's still Tim Burtonized, but it's still served pretty straight, Batman and Batman Returns, right? There are some comedic elements in there, but it's still, like, recognizably serious. By the time you get to the Joel Schumacher Batman, it's very 90s. It's very tongue-in-cheek. It's very the culture turning back on itself.
Self-consciously cheesy in the third and fourth one, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but by the time... And that's where I was going. And then, of course, you have literally Arnold Schwarzenegger in that movie, you know.
Oh, dear.
So...
That's a zero, that film. That's a zero out of 10.
I would say probably the only element of it is Arnie, like, because he at least seems to be aware of what he's in, I suppose.
That's among the very worst films I've ever seen. But the Tim Burton ones, that's a good fit. That's a very natural fit. That's a good director for Batman. That really works. I don't know why there's this consensus that the Nolan ones are automatically better, but I don't agree at all.
Yeah, I need to. I actually need to rewatch them for this. I'm hoping to rewatch them for. Deepest Law in 2 weeks' time, I think, is the movie one. You'd have to check the forward schedule, but it's just another example of how, like, how you get this kind of cycle where the seriousness or the earnestness of the 80s stuff starts to get undercut. It actually happened in pro wrestling as well, like probably like the least left-wing form of all, right? Because, like, literally Vince McMahon, who'd probably be a fascist if you wrote down his views, even in wrestling, you get a scenario where in the 80s, the heroes were, you know, Hulk Hogan, who's for, like, drinking his milk and taking...
I want to be American, yeah.
Yeah, you know, real American and all the rest of it. American. By the time you get to the late 90s, Kurt Angle, who's literally a gold, like an Olympic gold medalist, turns up in his Stars and Stripes talking about like the importance of integrity and intelligence and heroism, and the fans just boo him and tell him he fucking sucks.
He is a pure hypocrite though, isn't he, as well?
I mean, they played it up, but what I'm saying is, you would like in 1986 as opposed to 1996. I think he debuted in 1998. So let's say in 1988, you would not have been able to play an angle where or a storyline where an Olympic gold medalist comes in and he's a heel. He would have automatically been a de facto babyface. But something in the culture turned where you couldn't play it straight like that anymore. He had to be a heel under those conditions.
You notice that loads of the best wrestlers were baddies, weren't they? Like Benoit, Mr. Perfect, Ravishing Rick Rude. They were all like proper good. Arn Anderson. They were all really good wrestlers. They could do.
Oh yeah, there's a very good reason. There's a very good reason for that, Horace. And that is because conventionally the heel leads the match. And the baby face is like, so if you can imagine a dance, you're dancing, right? The dance partner leads. And all of those guys were, like Arn Anderson, for example, was so good that he could basically like call a match in the ring. You didn't need to script or anything.
Okay.
You could go in there as any old white meat baby face, and he could just lead you around by the nose. He'd make you look good. He'd make you look like $1 million. You know, he would make sure that there were puncture points in the match for you to get like massively cheered. He'd also make sure that he'd get his own shit in to, you know, make the crowd boo him, you know. So that's usually why it was.
Okay.
Heel, was the better wrestler, yeah.
Benoit took it a bit too far, didn't he?
it's not always that you can get great wrestlers who were on the face, like Ricky the Dragon Steamboat was a pure baby face who could lead the match, for example, but right. It was rarer on that side of things for the baby face to be the worker. Sometimes, like Rick Martel, if you remember him, he was a good wrestler who could lead as a baby face, but you probably remember him as a heel. Shall we move to the super chats or finish up on any last minute things on Nightmare before we finish up?
Thanks. I think I said my last piece on Nightmare. Loved it.
I'll just ask you a few questions then. Who was your favorite character going back watching the five seasons that you watched?
Apart from
Trayguard, yeah.
I quite like Morgana. I think was her name Morgana. It was before Lord Fear. You had Mogdred was usually the big baddie. He was fairly good. He just used to do the mwah thing.
Yeah, he's like this. I mean, I'll share my screen so you can.
It's fairly scary. Like, he was Mogdred. Well.
He was like the kind of. Was it fair to say he was the boss? He was like Merlin's, like Dark Shadow type thing.
Yeah, I think they're the same actor as well. But yeah, and then they sound quite different. But yeah, there was also Morgana, who was occasionally his role, and she was quite good looking and stuff, and she was really sinister, like. So I liked her. There you go.
Okay.
She's reasonably good.
And what was the best series in your view, and why?
I guess the second, because it was before they brought in the Ice Shield, which was a step down, I'd say. And before they took it, like, they took it out from season 3 or 4 onwards, they took it out to, like, forests and stuff, which was sometimes really good, like, in the tavern sometimes and all this. Could be really good, but overall, I didn't like the Ice Shield. I thought that was a waste of time. Season 2, it was, like, the original format, but they'd improved upon it from the first. So I'd say season 2.
Yeah. It's largely the same dungeon as well, like, with a couple of updates. Yeah. It seemed like the same, a lot of the same shots were used and so on. Okay. All right. So let's have a look at some super chats then. I'm glad that we did this. It was a big part of my childhood and an interesting kind of look at where things were then as a kid. I actually
when we rebuild civilization after the collapse and rebirth as well, I think there's lessons to be taken from Nightmare about how entertainment and so on should be done. So there's that as well. Oh, obviously, I sent you a super chat on the stream where you first mentioned this, and I said, I can't remember my exact words, but it was like, step one, restore Nightmare. Step two, retake Constantinopolis. As in, we might be able to get Britain back on its feet, but before we retake all of Europe, you know, from the Turk and stuff, people are going to need to study Nightmare. That's part of the Reconquista. Mm. So it trains children for the, it trains children for the martial life.
I'm kind of interested now in whether there's a correlation between the culture getting quote-unquote serious or less serious, depending on who's in power. Because it's just struck me thinking about Batman. Of course, 60s Batman is not is kind of postmodern and non-serious and pokes fun at itself. But of course, in the 60s, you had, you know, JFK and then LBJ in power. By the time you get to the 70s, obviously Batman's no longer on television. But like in the comics, it becomes very dark and gritty. And of course, film is very dark and gritty in the 70s. But for most of the 70s, like you have like Nixon and Gerald Ford in power, you know, and then, yeah, I just find it kind of interesting as to why you get these kind of dark, like not darker, but more serious turns in the culture versus less serious turns. And I wonder about that. Of course, we should remember the Tories were in power for most of the 90s in this country as well. But like John Major Tories was different from Maggie Thatcher Tories.
This started under Thatcher and then ended under Major. Perhaps that, you know, that says something like Thatcher was like, you know, sort of a cardinal sort of initiator force. And Major was like the force of decay and and failure.
Do you think it gets worse when the backgrounds become CG as opposed to hand painted though? Like, do you think...
It loses some of the...
I'll just show people what the difference is. So if you're the hand-painted backgrounds, you can see those as I'm scrolling through.
It's more immersive, the hand-painted, I think.
And then here are the CG backgrounds, which are really quite ugly to look at today. So
yeah, they just feel like what CGI does in films. It just feels unreal.
Yeah.
Whereas artistry... just is more human.
Oh, we didn't talk about him much. The dragon.
That's rubbish. Oh, no, sorry. That dragon. Sorry. Is that the dragon they fly on the back of?
Yeah.
Ah, that's rubbish. I'd get rid of all that. I thought it was lame.
In those live shows, the dragon is a large part of it, by the way. And it was voiced by a woman, and she used to shout, "Dragon! Dragon!" like that. It's kind of fun live, I suppose.
Okay.
But I took that and AAA has got a little cuddly toy dragon. I do that with that dragon. Anyway, let's hit the super chats then. Years the Eunuch says, Nightmare was so popular, even I heard about it in my mountain holler in Appalachia when I was a kid. I see you, AA, trying to make this obscure so your Daria spirit will allow you to like it. A little pokey out tongue.
Sorry, your Daria spirit.
does that surprise you? That I'll explain that in a second. Horace, does it surprise you that Nightmare was popular? Does it surprise you that kids in Appalachia, in the mountains, you know, in the Smoky Mountains of America, somewhere in the Midwest, had heard of Nightmare? Because it surprises me somewhat.
But it does a bit. But then I think sometimes the sort of quaint English stuff does travel quite well to America. They like to think of us as being into goblins and elves and all that, don't they? So
I'll see how it worked. I'll say something a bit unpopular, probably. I think British television is and has always been more inventive and creative than what comes out in America, because it's more like there's a more direct connection between creators and their product. So somebody could have a creative idea and it would get on to the BBC or on ITV like Nightmare, right? Whereas in America, everything has to go through like endless studio committees, and you know, things get pulled after half a season by fat executives. You know, it's all like too corporate in America, so they never let it, like, they strangle the creativity out of a lot of things.
I like to think that that was the story in America in the 80s, 90s, but there was some local TV station in Appalachia that just broadcast it, and only years saw it.
I'd love that to be the case. Let me see if I can find the Daria thing to explain.
She was saying, you've got a Daria soul, is that right?
Yes, so let me just share my screen here, Horace. This is actually a reference. I made a whole series of videos called Deconstructing the Boomer Regime.
I think I've seen the one about Daria now. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Generation X and the Rise of the Midwit. Now,
yeah.
I have always said that one of the reasons it's so difficult for people like me to find kind of faith or to drop this kind of natural cynicism that we have is because when we were kids, we were actually encouraged to be this Daria character. So, and it's not just Daria. Like, Daria is the most cynical, most kind of extreme version of it, right? Where she has this permanent kind of look on her face. She deconstructs everything around her. She psychoanalyzes. She's got like kind of rationalizations for everything. She has seen the broken homes of the boomers already, you know. But it's there in lesser ways in characters like Alvin from Alvin and the Chipmunks, or Raphael or Michelangelo from the Turtles, or like Bart Simpson. We were always encouraged to identify with the smart ass when we were little. And that smart arsery is at the heart of who being somebody of our generation. I mean, we were talking before we came on air about we're both technically millennials, right? But whatever you call this little micro zennial generation, we were encouraged to adopt this kind of sideways look at the world.
And so true.
And you know, this video, you'd be surprised if you click on that and read the comments. So many people just wrote things like, oh, it's like you took a microscope and looked at my soul, AA, or I felt really called out, or this is me to a T, and so on and so forth. It's definitely something. And I actually think it has extremely serious and long-lasting consequences. So, you know, when we talk about rebirth and collapse and so on, I think it's so deeply entrenched in us as children of the ashes, if you want, as Darias, that men from our generation will not be able to be the heroes that we need. I think we can help to pave the way, but all our skills in a strange way are destructive. Our skills are all like, we can pull things apart and deconstruct them and critique them and pull them apart. But I don't think our skills are in like asserting the heroic values in this straightforward and non-ironic way that is required. I even think now that, I mean, Abanike, I know everybody hates him, right? But if you ever watch Richard Spencer talk about heroism, he always does it with a smirk on his face and undercuts his point. Like, it always sounds like he may also be taking the piss out of what he's saying. And so it's never clear whether he's sincere or not.
Do you know what else undercuts the point? That he puts the fucking NATO and EU flags in his Twitter bio.
that as well. But you understand what I'm saying, though. Like,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
If I just made a massive video tomorrow saying, "Oh, listen, friends, I've converted and I now accept the Lord into my heart," I guarantee you that even if I was being 100% straight, at least like half the people just wouldn't believe it because of the difficulty that we have in being sincere and straight up in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, did you agree with that, Horace, or?
I do. I mean, and irreverence is part of the same mix as well. I think, I mean, I gave an example of it a minute ago when I was joking about the collapse and the rebirth and, you know, before we retake Constantinople, we need to, that is the same sort of thing, right? It's like joking about something that's actually going to be horrible, absolutely horrible, like, you know. you see, I'm laughing about it now, but yeah, so I agree. I mean, yeah, it's like it's become, people are actually really sort of uncomfortable about sincerity. I personally, I've actually consciously striven to overcome that because I think that cynicism can really kill you. That can make you ill, being so cynical and so, yeah, sort of irreverent. It's like, no, don't be like that all the time, for goodness sake.
But I mean, I've talked to more, like, I was listening to a show that Morgoth did with Todd Lewis, you know, the Praise of Folly one is. They were talking about, like, the prospect of nuclear war, right? Mm. In the 60s and the 70s, they lived under the shadow of the prospect of nuclear war, okay? Mm. And they were talking about how, you know, the British government or the American government would constantly play preparation scenarios for what would happen if there was a nuclear war. You know, shelters to go to, you know, hide under your table, whatever it is. Now we are in a very real situation, like a genuine situation where we could be on the brink of a nuclear war. And there hasn't been any prep of that nature whatsoever. It's just narrative. Like, now the prospect of nuclear war is just another narrative.
Our rulers in the media threatening us with nuclear war. That's basically what's happening.
The other thing that I've talked about with Morgoth is that... I don't know if you remember Alien, like the prospect of meeting aliens, you know, like, now this sounds bizarre, but a while back, like last year, the former head of the Israeli, like, space science team, like the chief rocket scientist of Israel, came out and basically just confirmed that, yes, aliens are real, yes, we've had contact and all the rest of it. It was published in all the newspapers. Nobody cared. Nobody batted an eyelid, and like literally people who we talked to just went, yeah, meh, we've seen it all before. Now, like, when we were teenagers, the idea that there would be aliens was a mind, like, not just mind blowing but epoch changing serious news. Now it's just like, oh yeah, we've seen this in movies 100 times already, nobody cares.
How did that happen? People who believed that aliens were out there and, you know, close to being contacted, they would say, can you imagine the moment when the media finally admit, or, you know, or when it comes out, when it finally comes out? It's like, no, but it does come out and no one gives a shit. Or it's not true, but no one's annoyed that it's not true. Yeah. Weird time, very weird time.
Infernal 460 says, this was one of my earliest kid shows I ever saw when CBBC was in a radio booth. Yes, but remember, of course, that this was on CITV and not CBBC. But yes, Utiz 4321 says, Horus, any plans on new content?
Yeah, I'm researching for a new video at the moment. It's going to be about the European Union. The book I'm reading to do it is really long, so I'm still reading through the book. I'm getting towards the end. And you know, I read it carefully to take notes and stuff, but also I then hit on another dimension, so I might make it more ambitious, but it also means it will take longer as well, because I've decided to read all the books of Kudnov Kadaji as well, and relate that to it. I am working on new content, but I don't know, it could be more weeks yet.
Somebody in the chat was saying that people in their generation also mock and deconstruct those nuclear fallout movies as well.
Right.
The duck and cover stuff, you know.
There was the War Game. Have you ever seen the War Game?
No, I haven't. What's that?
It was banned. It was by Peter Watkins. I don't know. He's apparently famous for other things. I think he might have done Kathy Come Home or something. Anyway, the War Game is a mixed drama documentary. And the documentary is supposed to be, well, it's just the reality of what would happen in contrast to the government videos. It's based in Britain. And it's like, right. it's like, you know, they tell you that, yeah, you might have to like budge up and house someone else in your home or something, but your home will be fine and you'll eat basically normally. There'll be some things will be rationed, but you'll be fine and all this stuff. And then they show the reality of it. It's just like society coming apart, you know, like Threads, similar to Threads, but made in the 60s. It's really hard hitting for the time.
I mean, the thing is, if a nuclear bomb went off and I hid under my table, it would just like fucking nobody would send a shot. Everything would just be disintegrated, right? Is that not the case?
Yeah, well, it depends how close you are to the center, doesn't it?
My only frame of reference is that scene from Terminator 2, as I said. The Sarah Connor vision, you know.
You want to be in the blast, really. Like, what is the point in trying to live in a post-nuclear holocaust? Like, what? It's more miserable. Like, they say that in the war game. They say, would the living come to envy the dead? And I think it's literally true. I'd rather just be vaporized.
And I remember playing Fallout 2. It was pretty depressing, to be honest. You know,
war never changes. Ron Perlman says that.
Yuck's Interior says, a friend was on this. When you reach the end of the room, a burly crew member would grab you by the shoulders and turn you in the right direction.
There you go. I assume that must be true because they can't have a huge warehouse, can they? Like, it's got to be sort of directed to some extent physically.
Nathan CJ Hood says Walter White was a variant of the cool geek. I suppose he was. Did you watch Breaking Bad or us?
I saw one episode. No, not much.
I did enjoy your break. I thought it was very good television. Although I will say that by like season 5 or 6, the constant face and heel turns they start to get a bit telegraphed after a while. It's just like, come on, he's turning face now. And you know, well, the thing is that a lot of people were comparing Breaking Bad to Shakespeare because, you know, the shades of gray, it's not clear who the good guys are and who the bad guys are, sympathetic villain, all this sort of stuff, or anti-hero, which is a lot of, you know, Shakespeare has a lot of this stuff in it. But I was like, yeah, but what about the excessively telegraphed face and heel turns? You don't really get those in Shakespeare to the same extent. Well, so.
And also, what they're saying, what, they copied Shakespeare? Like, is that impressive or what?
I did enjoy Breaking Bad, though. There are like the other problem with Breaking Bad is that American TV has got this very set thing where, like, I don't know, was it 24 episodes to a season or 25 episodes to a season? So every once in a while you get these like obvious filler episodes where nothing happens.
Yeah.
So we need to fucking tread water for an hour. So let's I don't know, do a character study for an hour just to pad out the time.
It's painfully obvious. It's like, yo, this episode doesn't matter. Great.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't know. I did enjoy. There were a few other parts of Breaking Bad that I don't know if they've been absorbed into the language of television now, because I don't really watch a lot of box sets and things. I never got it. I hated that box set. There was a whole period of time where everybody was like, oh, you have to watch this. It's the best show ever. Do you remember that whole thing? The box set whole thing. I never got into that.
It'd be The Wire. They're talking about The Wire, aren't they?
Yeah, The Wire or whatever happened to be. One of the things I appreciated about Breaking Bad is that they wouldn't, like, they did treat the audience as intelligent. It'd be like, okay, all of these things need to happen. We don't actually need to see them play out. So you can just do like a cold edit. We'll take those things as read and we'll pick up the action after that point. We don't have to laboriously watch it all. So it was quite good in that way. It was also quite good in, like, it wasn't constantly stopping to hold your hand, and I appreciated that. Although I can't remember exactly how I watched it, but I didn't watch it on American television, and I was told that when it was shown on American TV, they put these like wraparounds on it for the idiot American audience. So maybe they relied on those wraparounds.
What is that, where it tells you what happened in the last episode or something?
Yeah, you know, the whole, like, oh, on last week's show, you know. Right. Like, I can't remember those elements in it when I watched it, so.
I don't need those because I usually watch. I never watch things when they're being released. I wait till they're finished, you know, like, and then watch them in a row, you know, like, rather than because I can't stand waiting a week. Like the same with Nightmare, but I can't stand waiting a week for the next episode of anything.
Sod yeah, the only thing I've done that with in recent memory is I did it with Line of Duty, which is probably the only bit of normie TV I've watched in the past 10 years. Game of Thrones. I did it with Game of Thrones as well.
Was Line of Duty like a Robson and Jerome thing or something?
No, Line of Duty was Line of Duty was this. It was like a. It's about. It's a really good show. I really enjoyed it. It's about an internal police department that called AC-12, who are dedicated to rooting out like corruption within the police. It's kind of interesting because there's like a kind of pedos in the elite angle to it. Mm. It's kind of worth a watch. But I don't know. I thought it was some pretty good television. Gorm Den Gamil says, "Hey, have you ever listened to Alan Watt? Not the philosopher, but the conspiracy Scotsman. If not, please do and see if you can think he can add something. I've never heard of Alan Watt. Have you, Horace?"
I've heard of the Taoist philosopher guy. I don't know much about the other guy. I've heard of him, but
yeah, I'm not aware of him, I'm afraid.
The philosopher guy, he talks about the Tao, you know, like the Tao. Like, it's interesting if you want to learn about Eastern philosophy. It's good, but yeah.
A Winter Phoenix Forest Corinne says, "Do a sword and sorcery, Deepest Lore, please." I'd have to see if Semi-Agog would be up for that. I don't actually know if Semi-Agog likes sword and sorcery stuff, but if he doesn't, I would just be shocked. I can just, like, you know, there's no way that guy wasn't into early 80s sword and sorcery films. So
pork sword and sorcery would be a good minor genre as well. As in, I'm being bawdy there, sorry.
All right. Anything you'd like to shill coming up, Horace?
If people want to, I think my Odyssey channel is linked below. I'm on Telegram as well. I think if you search for Warmaster Horace on Telegram, you'll find me. But yeah, I haven't made any new videos for the best part of a year. I am getting back into it now with the one I mentioned about the European Union, which is not particularly salient as we have left the EU, but I think it should be an interesting historical video. And I'm planning to do a stream about Bitcoin and central banking and inflation and debt. And I'm doing that, I think, with Urbadurba, but I'm also probably going to do a panel show after that. So as you're someone who's versed in Austrian economics and so on, you might be interested. But I'll come back to you about that. I spoke to Radical Liberation about that and some other people. And, I think that this decade we're going to see a major, like, epoch-defining transformation in debt and inflation. That's quite far removed from Nightmare, though. So, yeah, that's something I'm gradually working on.
People are unhappy that I said Line of Duty was good.
Well, I just immediately thought of Soldier, but it's different. Yeah. You're talking about, like, an internal affairs thing, right?
Do you know Daughter of Albion, right? She was very upset that I said that the woman in Line of Duty was quite hot, because she's extremely butch.
Okay.
Let me see if I can find the picture of her to show you what I'm on about.
Is Daughter of Albion extremely butch as well?
No. Daughter of Albion. But basically, when I show Daughter of Albion this, she said, "Are you gay?" Let me just show you what I'm talking about. One of the main characters in that show looks like this. Let me just show you if I can get it up. Have you seen what she looks like?
You said if I can get it up, so I said
ooh. Oh, I see. Right. There she is. Look, she's I mean, to be fair, she does look like she would be a lesbian, but, you know.
Oh, wait, isn't she in This Is England as well?
She is in This Is England. She's in like a few other things as well.
So not butch, a bit severe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like in some scenes, she does get a lot butcher than others. Like, I mean, like there, for example.
She's a naturally good-looking woman.
But I think she's good-looking. You know,
yeah, she's good-looking. I mean, I don't particularly fancy her, but I appreciate, you know, I admire her face and stuff.
Yeah,
it's a bit of a blokey haircut, I suppose. But she's not butch in any other. She's not muscular or anything, is she? Like, she's not got stubble.
there we go.
It's always good not to have stubble.
All right. Pick up a course, join the channel, buy a mug. Remember later on AA Gold, I shared the link on my community tab. I'm going to be doing a review of the Women's Hour show with Red Hawk. And other than that, I'll see you tomorrow night for Unpopular Opinions.
Thanks for having me, AA. Really enjoyed this.
Now get out.